Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast by NHS Providers. My name's Adam Brimelow, and in this episode, we're marking World Mental Health Day. When it was first celebrated in 1992, World Mental Health Day focused on promoting mental health advocacy and educating the public. Since then, each year has had a specific theme. This year, it's Make Mental Health and Wellbeing for All a Global Priority. This podcast episode will reflect on that theme and what it means for the NHS and for mental health more broadly. In a moment, we'll hear from NHS Providers Interim Chief Executive Saffron Caudrey and the Chief Executive of Derbyshire Healthcare NHS Foundation Trust, Ifti Majid. But first, let's hear from Sarah Klein, co-founder and Chief Executive of United for Global Mental Health. I asked her, what was the particular significance of this year's theme for World Mental Health Day?
This year's World Mental Health Day is about equity. It's about making mental health a priority around the world. But that means not just talking about it, but actually acting on that. And that means giving people around the world access to better mental health treatment and care and more support for them in their communities. And that also means reducing stigma and discrimination, which prevents people from seeking support, but also when they do seek support, can sometimes prevent them from getting the support that they need.
We know, Sarah, that the treatment gap for common mental health conditions can be as high as 90% in some low-income countries. Why do you think this is, and what is the impact of that?
The treatment gap is very low in low middle-income countries in particular. There are a few reasons for that. First, budget. Mental health is on average 2% of health budgets around the world. In a low middle-income country, that typically falls below 1%. And the vast majority of that money will be spent on tertiary care. So there's very little resource that's available for people who go looking for support for their mental health. And one of the things that we try really hard to advocate for, along with the WHO and others, is for a redistribution of resources for mental health. So much more emphasis on community-based care rather than tertiary-based care.
So you mentioned there the importance of community-based care. I suppose in terms of a wider question, what do you think we can do to tackle the inequalities in mental health care access and outcomes?
One of the first things to tackle when it comes to inequality around mental health is the prejudices that people experience. So the stigma and discrimination that people experience, whether it's amongst family members, amongst their community, or even when they go to seek support. So the first thing we need to do is reduce that stigma and discrimination and educate people better so they understand what mental health really means, where they can go for support and the kinds of support they should expect to receive. The second step is to encourage more support in the community, in schools, and also in the workplace. Employers also have a duty of care for physical and mental health. So if all of those things are working well, then the pressure on health systems will be less and people will find the support where they need it most.
So you described there some of those practical steps that can make a difference. What do you see as being the biggest opportunities for improving access to and the quality of mental health care?
I think there are a few things which would really improve access. One is looking very seriously at the opportunities that digital healthcare provide. So in some cases, people can go looking for support online or through digital support, whether that's chatbots, whether that's signposting and access to online services or information. Those are important sources of support for some people. A second area is peer-to-peer support. So encouraging people to talk to others in a situation similar to themselves, some moderated conversations, discussions. Very often it helps people with a mental health condition to talk to others in a similar position to them and to try and derive some benefit and some support from one another. And similarly for families supporting people with a mental health condition, they also benefit from talking to other families. And then the third element is training. So making sure that people who are likely to come into contact with someone with a mental health condition feel able and sufficiently trained to respond in the right way. So that's mental health first aid training, But then, of course, for healthcare professionals, it's making sure there is sufficient training on mental health as part of everybody's basic training package.
We know that mental health as an issue has been greatly exacerbated during the period of the pandemic. We're seeing those pressures in the NHS now. What lessons do you think the NHS can learn from our international colleagues?
I think all countries everywhere have struggled during COVID and post-COVID with the burden that mental health has presented. And that's both from patients seeking support, but also the burden on healthcare professionals themselves and their own mental health needs. I think there are a few things that are important. So one is prioritising the mental health care and support for staff members and making sure that it's not simply an emphasis on individual resilience, but there are sources of support. I think the second thing is a joined up approach with other sectors. So it's not just what happens in the health sector, but it's also what happens in the education sector, social services, in judicial systems. And I think that's something that other countries have also worked quite hard to do, which is a whole of society approach and a multi-sectoral approach. So those are two things that are important to think about. The third area that I think is important is to look at stigma and discrimination. So if people feel able to come forward and seek support for their mental health early, then obviously they can prevent a serious escalation in mental ill health and try and prevent cases developing of things like psychosis. So if you can get early intervention, it can really help in a whole range of conditions. So one of the things that we've seen in other countries is that emphasis on early intervention and on support, particularly for children and adolescents, so that the more prevention means less crisis care needed at a later stage.
Sarah Klein. And Sarah also mentioned the launch of the Lancet Commission report on ending stigma and discrimination in mental health, which includes a review of the evidence on effective interventions to reduce stigma. On now to Saffron Caudray, Interim Chief Executive at NHS Providers. I began by asking her, why is World Mental Health Day important?
I think that days that focus on specific issues are really important because they give us the time and the opportunity to step back and think, what does a specific topic mean to us? And how do we really reaffirm our efforts to keep it in the public eye and top of our agenda? So to have a World Mental Health Day feels really important to me. And I think that it's really important that we're talking about World Mental Health Day, because we know that across the globe, ensuring that we can really focus on bringing that parity and equity in an unequal world in terms of mental health is absolutely critical.
And you mentioned that global theme, and particularly with the aftermath of the pandemic, that really was a global phenomenon, wasn't it, in terms of its impact on mental health?
Absolutely. We know that COVID-19 had a massive impact on physical health, but what is less focused on is mental health. And the World Health Organization has said that COVID-19 created a global crisis for mental health. And I think we really need to think about what it has meant, particularly for those countries who haven't been able to really focus on putting the mental health provision in place that they might need to. But we have seen across the globe estimates in the region of 25% increases in things like anxiety and depression. And we've seen mental health services significantly disrupted, and a big treatment gap for mental health conditions has emerged. And I think we have to remember as well that this is the case in our country and across the NHS. So we know that NHS services are busier than ever before. They're really struggling to keep up with demand. And that's a mental health impact on those who are waiting for the services, but it's also really difficult for staff themselves, both those working in physical health, unable to provide the care they may wish to, and the mental load that then foists upon them. But it's also really challenging for mental health staff who are in a double caring role, looking after their own health and well-being, but also that of their patients and service users. Just to carry on that theme, I think it's really important also to note that we have got now millions waiting for mental health care, around 1.7 million in May 2022. And the number of children and young people is actually three times higher than when the records began. So we have seen that huge increase in the level of demand for mental health services.
You mentioned children and young people in terms of that mental health impact in this country. Are there any specific areas in terms of NHS activity, mental health activity that you're especially concerned about as we look at the figures?
As we look at the figures, it's definitely the case that we need to really focus on children and young people, CAM services, so child and adolescent mental health services. And in particular within that, we've seen a real spike in the demand for eating disorders. But then beyond that, we need to think about access to services overall, because it's absolutely critical that we are putting in place a mental health provision that meets the needs of children, adults and older people too.
Saffron Cordery there. And more from Saffron in a moment. But on now to Wifty Majid, Chief Executive at Derbyshire Healthcare NHS Foundation Trust. I asked him how have people's mental health needs changed in recent years and how has his trust responded?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question, because I think we're yet to fully understand the, if you like, the social and economic legacy that we've had from COVID. It is definitely having an impact on people's mental health and well-being. I think probably in two main ways, or certainly what we're seeing is in two main ways. The number of people seeking help is increasing, and I would say is in increasing across the board, but also something different, which is around the severity and complexity of how people are presenting, is also increasing. And so I think what we're seeing locally mirrors, you know, the national picture, with just under 700,000 children and young people accessing support, which is a massive growth compared to where we were a few years ago in children. And I think it's something like a 20% increase in number of older adults and adults accessing IHAP services, and a massive increase in autism referrals, about 40% across the country. So we are seeing this increase across our sector. And I think what it means is that we're needing to respond with new models. So things like our 24-hour helpline, which across the country, including us in Derbyshire, we stood it up very, very quickly, and that's kept going. So our the community mental health framework, which is actually the biggest change in community mental health services probably since the early 2000s, is all about working in different ways, working with new partners to meet increased demand. And then locally, we've done some things like a different autism support service and creating alternatives to admission for people that need that, things like crisis response for children. So I think it's things like that we're doing, but there is some innovations as well. So our pharmacists, for example, in Derbyshire Healthcare use something called Consultant Connect, where they can give advice very quickly to GPs, which just helps that flow of people needing to necessarily come into secondary care. And I think what we learned from COVID around digital is something that we need to continue to think about. So how do we give choice around how people want to engage with services, as well as thinking about risk in terms of whether we use digital or face-to-face, for example? Yeah, so I think quite big change, I would say, over the last few years.
Yeah, you certainly talk about big change, a big increase in demand requiring innovation. Another area I know there's been real concern has been the way that the impact of the pandemic in particular has exacerbated health inequalities. So what can be done there, both in terms of prevention, work upstream, but also improving access to mental health care?
First of all, we need to understand what those health inequalities are, don't we? And we need to use the integrated care systems. We need to use some of the work that we're now doing with the local authority, with councils, to make sure that we have got mental health inequalities firmly on the agenda. And, you know, as you suggest, the impacts are still absolutely startling, aren't they? We know that the IHAT recovery rates, for example, are very different depending on what communities you come from. We know that people with a learning disability still die significantly earlier than people in the general population, for example, equally so people with mental health problems. So having those conversations is the first most important thing. I have to say, I think there is something about the basics, but given that our previous conversation about demand, sometimes the basics can be difficult. But things like physical health checks. So how do we make sure that people who are using our mental health services and our learning disability services get the required physical health checks? And I think there's something different in how we work with primary care. So I suppose I feel and I have the view that the old adage about every contact counting, you know, for me, it's who's having the contact with the individual. And that's the person that should be looking to understand their physical health and mental health. So we also do things like health facilitation. So we have a team that will support people with learning disability going into an acute trust to get their physical health care checks. Those sorts of things, how we help, we support, we enable people with mental health and learning disability to look after their physical health is really important. But it's also things like vaccinations, you know, very topical at the moment in terms of flu and COVID booster. And we have an award-winning health facilitation hub that actually offers a different environment, calming, de-escalating, slower pace, but really effective in getting high levels of individuals with mental health and learning disability vaccinated. And I've mentioned before the community mental health framework, and I think some of these new models that start to link mental health services with primary care, I think as we start to work in a more joined up way in place, but also with people in the voluntary and community sector who have even more contact with people who use our services quite often, these are the opportunities that we need to take to increase physical health care and therefore start to reduce health inequalities.
Yeah, and FD, when you describe the scale of those challenges and some of the responses that are coming into play here, how important is inclusive leadership in terms of being able to develop and then deliver an appropriate response?
So I think this gets to the heart of what we need to be thinking about as individual organisations. And there's a difference, isn't there, between inclusion and diversity, inclusive leadership and diversity. And I tend to think that diversity is describing the current state, the environment, whereas actually inclusive leadership is describing how we make people feel. And that's what's really important, because there's something for me about, as leaders, how we create an environment where everybody thrives, where everybody can be their best, where everybody can bring their whole selves, whether that's as a colleague or whether that's as somebody that needs our help and support. And the answer to what inclusive leadership is all about is broader than we might think, because when you talk to people in organisations, what they say to you is they will feel included if they can tell you when things aren't right, if they feel that their successes are celebrated, if they can be thanked, if they feel developed, if they feel understood, if they can have an impact on their job really meaningfully. Those are the things that as leaders we need to be focusing on, which means that we need to be, you know, collaborative, visible. We need to have high levels of cultural intelligence, actually understanding our own heritage and how it impacts on our leadership. Being prepared as leaders to have difficult conversations about things like privilege, colonialism, which, you know, we perhaps historically have shied away from. And I also think that as leaders, there is something about you can behave in a certain way, which means that you, you know, avoid being discriminatory. Or we can work to be anti-discriminatory. And that's something different. You know, that is taking specific action to ensure that those things that I was talking about earlier come into play, and actually as leaders being personally accountable and holding ourselves personally accountable for that feels really important. And if we do that, then this isn't me as a mental health nurse being a little bit focused on emotions. Actually, the evidence is really strong. You just need to look at the evidence from the Harvard Business Review, Michael West's evidence about effectiveness and impact on patients. That's what inclusive leadership's all about. The organisations that are deemed as being inclusive have better clinical outcomes, better services for people that need them. And one last thing, if I may, which is something about what I think our core role of leaders is, which is about being accountable to our local communities. And I think if we don't put ourselves into a place where we develop our own cultural intelligence, then how can we demonstrate to our local communities that we can lead services and lead the development of services that are culturally appropriate, culturally accessible, culturally relevant? Because that's what we need to be doing. And if we don't do that, we're not going to improve outcomes.
So what else now can be done to make mental health a priority in the NHS and more broadly?
Yeah, and there's a few things, I think, isn't there? We're at a time of change and a time of pressure, I think, in the NHS. I put great store, you know, on the link between providers in the mental health sector and the national team. We've got a very strong link, and I think that's an important connection for us because it gives us as providers influence, we feel heard, and it gives our national team, Claire Murdoch and colleagues, the ability to share more broadly within NHS England how it's feeling on the ground in mental health. So I think that must be protected in the new operating model that we move into. That feels really important to me. I think the second thing is there's a lot talked about, isn't there? And there's a currency that is well known about things like elective recovery, ambulance turnaround. So there's a lot of those sorts of things talked about. We need to make it clear what our version of those things are. So I think we need to work really hard that when we're talking about people who no longer need to be in hospital, that actually that is equally relevant to mental health inpatient services. I think when we're talking about elective recovery, we need to constantly be saying, remember that waiting lists giving increasing demand are growing in mental health services, not only primary waits, but secondary waits as well. And I think we have our own equivalent of ambulance turnarounds as well, which is those people that need to be in inpatient care. And we haven't got beds, and therefore we're working with them at high levels of risk in the community. So we need to have those conversations and make that sort of well known nationally. And I think the last thing I'd say is one thing I've noticed is that COVID has done wonders for stigma. So we talk about mental health a lot more now than we used to, don't we? But I think that we still tend to talk about mental health either around various campaign times or when there is some sort of tragedy. And actually, we need to keep the narrative going all the time. We need to talk about mental health all the time, given the high impact it has on people's health across the country.
Ifti Majid. So finally, back to Saffron Caudray and the issue of parity of esteem for mental health services in the NHS. How much progress has been made?
I think that we can look at inequalities in a number of ways, and yeah, we can cut it many different ways. And I think it both drives mental health need and it also impacts on access to mental health care. So we need to look at both of those elements. I think in terms of inequalities for those experiencing mental ill health, we need to think about wider inequalities. So we need to think about things like housing and employment and deprivation. And we know that there is a definite link between demand for mental health services and those who are experiencing economic deprivation. We saw it with the changes to universal credit. We are seeing it now in terms of issues with cost of living. So that is a really important area. I think the other thing that we need to remember is that there are some genuine life impacts of those who suffer serious mental illness. Broader unmet health needs mean that those with serious mental illness will die on average 15 to 20 years before the rest of the general population. And I think that this underlines the need to make sure that we are looking after the whole person when they present in whatever setting they are presenting in. So I think that, you know, those are some of the areas that we need to think about when we are thinking about wider health inequalities. But then we also need to think about what does it mean in terms of accessing mental health care? So how do we make sure that everyone has access to mental health care? We know that a recent review found that ethnicity is a particular factor which can impact on people seeking help from services, reduces the opportunity for provision of the right kind of treatment and support. And we do know that those from ethnic minority communities are also more likely to be compulsorily detained or treated. So that's a really stark inequality. And I think the final piece on the inequality agenda for mental health is the fact that we see a long-standing historic structural disadvantage facing mental health provision, and that impacts across the piece. So in terms of access to services, experience and outcomes. So we have to be really clear about the sector receiving its fair share of revenue and capital investment and making sure that the funding mechanisms themselves are more transparent, and that we're really clear that our expectation is that everybody with a mental health condition should be able to access treatment.
Saffron, we're in a new landscape now with the development of system working really sort of taking shape. How much do you think that process presents an opportunity to address some of these issues?
I think that equity for mental health within the system context is a fundamental element of what we should be seeking to achieve with system working, because its ultimate aim is around improving population health, improving equality, really seeking to drive out those determinants of poorer health so that we improve the health of our local populations. I think that what we saw in the Health Act that's recently gone through Parliament is that there are now expectations of the government that mental health spending by NHS England and integrated care boards is increased. ICBs have to report on mental health spending, and they must include within their membership an individual who has the expertise and knowledge of mental illness. So that is an important factor. Another important factor is that there is this strategic context called the triple aim, which should have an impact alongside broader developments such as the cross-government mental health plan. But I think the most important element from system working is that we need to see the relationships built between different organisations at a local level in order to understand the needs of mental health services and make sure that those needs are met and that the contribution that mental health services make is fully recognised. So a really good example of that is making sure that the role of mental health services is fully factored in when we're thinking about things like urgent and emergency care, because we know that an A&E department or an ambulance is not the right place for anybody who is suffering a mental health crisis. And we really need to get to the bottom of how we manage and overcome some of those challenges and look at the contribution mental health can make to tackling some of the trickiest issues.
So Saffron, how would you summarise what more is needed from the government and from the NHS national leadership?
I think that what we need to see now is a genuine focus on mental health. We need to keep it up there on the priority list. So we need to make sure that we address the health inequalities that exist within mental health care. We need to make sure that should it emerge within the new administration, that the cross-government mental health plan is radical, bold and transformational, and critically comes with a budget to deliver it, because getting that cross-organisation, cross-government buy-in to mental health approaches is a really sound and really important idea. But without the budget to deliver it, that's going to be really, really challenging. And then the final piece is actually about making sure that we plough ahead with the legislation to reform the Mental Health Act. That's currently undergoing pre-legislative scrutiny. It's been years in the making now. It's been the subject of huge engagement across all parts of the mental health stakeholder community, the service user community, the statutory sector. And we really need to make sure that we see those changes, because they are important changes about choice and autonomy, about therapeutic benefit, and about treating people as individuals. So those are the kind of changes that we need to see going forward to make sure that mental health really sits at the top of the priority list.
Saffron Caudry there from NHS Providers. Well, that's it for this time. My thanks to Sarah Klein, Iftia Majid and Saffron Caudry. Remember, you can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast, and keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you.